Thank you for joining us. We are Thoughtful Therapists. Where shall we begin?
Bob Withers is a training analyst with the Society of Analytical Psychology and former senior lecturer in psychology and the history and philosophy of medicine at the University of Westminster. He is a founding member of the Rock Clinic, a charitable community-based psychotherapy clinic in Brighton. His interest in transgender issues began in the early 90s when he worked analytically with a male-to-female-to-male detransitioner. This experience alerted him to the vital importance of trans people thoroughly addressing their psychological issues before making permanent changes to their bodies that they could later regret. Since then, he has published 3 book chapters and 2 articles on transgender issues, including the paper Transgender Medicalization. He has also made several media appearances, contributed to newspaper articles, and lectured widely on the subject. Today, Bob is hoping to outline a way of understanding and working with gender dysphoria that utilizes Winnicott's approach to the mind and body relationship. Thank you, Bob, for joining us this evening.
Thank you for asking me.
So just on our introduction there, which sort of skates over your career so far, Bob.
Yeah. But
if we can just go back a little bit, can you tell us a bit more about that early experience?
Yeah, I mean, I'd always been interested in the body and the mind-body relationship, actually. I studied philosophy at university and specialised in mind-body philosophy. And also, I was kind of caught up in the complementary medical craze in the 1970s and 80s and trained and practiced as an acupuncturist and homeopath. So I got very used to working with the body and thinking about the body. And a lot of the people I saw had what could be called psychosomatic problems, if you're thinking about it psychologically. Then I did some research on homeopathy and realized that it was working not for physical, but for psychological reasons largely. So it's a little bit like the trans thing in some ways, because homeopathy has quite powerful physical effects on a person's body and their state of well-being, but there isn't any physical reason for it working. And I think it's a bit the same with the effects of hormones and surgery. They do have a powerful effect on the person's body, but I think a lot of the way that they work is through psychological, you know, forces. So I then decided it was only ethical to go back and train as a psychotherapist, which I did. And then quite early in my career in the 1990s, I got referred this patient who I call Chris, who was very clear that he should have had proper psychotherapy before he transitioned, but he was not really questioned or challenged. He was just encouraged to go down the surgical and the medical route, which he deeply regretted. So, for instance, when he woke up from the surgery to have his penis removed, the first thing he said was, "I feel as if all the anger has been cut out." So it was a kind of great moment for him when he could become the girl that he'd always identified with. But the identification as a female for him was as much a dissociation from hated male parts of himself represented by the penis. He'd had extremely negative experiences with a father who'd been sexually abusive to his brother, violent to his mother, and was an alcoholic, and then left the family age 4, you know, when my patient was age 4. So violently dissociated from any masculine traits in his own personality. And those traits, I believe, got projected into his body and into his penis in particular. And then he wanted to dissociate himself as much as possible from any remaining vestiges or traces, physical traces, of what he experienced as toxic masculinity. Of course, when he lived as a woman, took estrogen, didn't do away with his anger, and he found himself exploding in the same sorts of psychotic rages that he'd been trying to get away from by identifying as a woman. And that's really what made me think this is difficult to work with psychologically, but vital that we try and do it if we're to prevent other people regretting the sort of medical treatment that he ended up regretting, because it didn't do what he hoped it would do and what he felt he was sold. He felt he was sold it by a medical industrial complex as a solution to a complicated series of emotional problems. I might say, as well as being traumatized by his father, he also was autogynephilic, which he felt very guilty about. You know, he used to like dressing up in front of the mirror and imagining making love with himself, and that was his sort of preferred form of sexual satisfaction. And he felt so ashamed after that that he would get into a rage, smash things up, destroy his wardrobe. And he thought if he actually became the woman in the mirror, then he might get away from the guilt and the shame. So listen, if I just sort of stop there for one moment and say, try and encapsulate what I'm trying to say on a theoretical basis using Winnicott's ideas, if I could.
Yes, that would be great.
All right. So what I'm saying is that he had projected hated parts of his psyche into his body and dissociated from that body. Does that make sense? The hate and the sexual feeling, the arousal when he dressed up as a woman, the thoughts about himself that he felt were violent and aggressive. He had a sort of pull towards sadomasochism in the sexual relationships that he had. And he hated all of those things about himself. But he associated those things with his male side of his personality. I mean, I think if we think about who we are personality-wise, we've all got male parts, female parts, child parts. You know, we've all got a multitude of personalities or parts of the psyche within us. What matters is how do these parts get on with each other? And what I'm postulating that for him and for probably a considerable proportion of trans people, one feature is that the disowned part is associated with something very negative, which has to be forcefully dissociated from. So that's step one. If that part is projected into the body and the psyche dissociates further from the body, so there's what Winnicott would call a mind-body dissociation, then the identity appears to be set up in a disembodied state. So in his case, he could identify as female, even though he didn't have a female body. But that involved a dissociation from the body and an identification with the disembodied female part of his mind, and B, a dissociation from the male part of his personality. So there was a double dissociation, a mind-body dissociation and a male-female dissociation, with the female part of the psyche becoming the center of the ego. You know, what he experienced as himself was himself as a woman. He felt female. And I would say his disembodied psyche has identified with the female part of his psyche and dissociated from the male part of his psyche, which is then projected into the body. So I would say that for a significant number of people, there is a similar process of mind-body and male-female dissociation going on when a person feels gender dysphoria. So we can think about gender dysphoria as a dissociation between the mind and the body, and the discomfort that arises if you psychologically or subjectively identify with somebody who is the opposite sex to your sex body. So there's a dissociation between the mind and the body, and the body is then omnipotently altered to fit in with the mind. What I'm trying to say as a psychotherapist before doing that is it possible to find a way of working effectively psychotherapeutically with the mind of the person in order to help it accept the body more? In other words, how to undo the dissociation? That's where Winnicott comes in, because he says people usually dissociate from their body because there's something painful and traumatic about that body. In my patient's case, it's obvious it was a form of sexuality that he couldn't cope with, but it could be anything. There might be, you know, you might be somebody who doesn't symbolize very well. You might be on the autistic spectrum. And when you get into a conflict, you might not recognize that you're in a conflict, but you might find something painful happening in your body, which is a representation of a difficult emotional experience. Now, this is where Winnicott comes in again, because he says that if the psychotherapist tries to help the person reconnect with the body, if you like, to bring the mind back into the intimate connection with the body, that, you know, we're all seeking to be whole. None of us want to be dissociated. There's a part of us that wants to get back into touch with our body because we've dissociated from it to protect ourselves from pain. But if we want to get back in touch, we're going to have to face the pain that's caused us to dissociate in the first place. And that's the difficulty working with the person who has a somatic or a physical symptom where the body feels uncomfortable, but actually it's the psyche or the mind that is associated with that body symptom, which is the problem. So the therapist that tries to get the person who's dissociated from their hate say, or their sexuality, is going to have to face that person getting in touch with the feeling that they've dissociated from and projected into the body. In order to get that person back in touch with their body, the therapist is going to face the resistance, really, to re-encountering the painful feeling. And that's where, I mean, Winnicott's got a complete package on this, because he talks in his paper, Hate in the Counter-Transference, about sometimes how difficult it is to end up in a position as a therapist where you actually hate the patient. So you're trying to help this person. And I worked a lot with psychosomatic people with these sorts of problems, particularly when I was doing complementary medicine. And they might feel something in their body. And you're able to see from, well, when did this symptom start? And is there anything that comes to mind? What is the body symptom? What's it feel like? So working with these sort of emotions, which are split off and captured by the body, can be very difficult and very challenging. So I think as therapists, we need to be able to, A, work with the body in a way which we're not thoroughly trained to do, but B, work with the fact that if we do help the person get in touch with the split off emotion that's in their body, we're going to be on the receiving end of a lot of their resistance, which can include hatred. So somebody might be storing a body memory, which they don't know anything about psychologically, where they've been abused. And you might find the person going back and reliving the abuse when they're focusing on the abdominal pain, let's say. And as a therapist, you're trying to help that person integrate an experience that they haven't managed. But when the patient says, I'm just feeling that you're really abusing me here because I don't want to even think about where this pain is coming from, then you're in a difficulty as a therapist, because you can either back off. I mean, obviously, a lot of our training is to try and help us work empathically without forcing people against their will. But even when people have a free association to a pain, or they have a dream that they talk about, or they unwillingly flash back, you know, automatically flash back to difficult experience in the session, as a therapist, it's painful to see the person witness that. And it's painful to be hated by the patient for putting the patient back in touch with an experience that a part of them wants to distance themselves from. I think there's always a deeper part which wants to go back and reintegrate the dissociated part of the experience. But the knack and the difficulty is how to support that part that wants to bring about reintegration or individuation, if you think in a Jungian form, how to work with that in a way that doesn't overwhelm the person with an affect that they can't really manage or they don't want to face. So you're either, on the one hand, you're in a danger of forcing a person too quickly into an experience they're going to be overwhelmed by. The other danger is you're so frightened of that that you dissociate from it yourself and you ignore it and you just reinforce the mind-body dissociation. Now, unfortunately, I think that's what quite a lot of affirmative therapists are doing. I think they're reinforcing a mind-body dissociation by saying, what's real is your mind, your gender identity. If you say you're a woman, but you're biologically a body, we will affirm the mind. We will affirm the gender identification, and we will deny the body. And for me, that's a reinforcement of a mind-body dissociation. My big question actually would be, why do we affirm the mind and deny the body? Why do we try and convert the body to try and fit in with the mind? And for me, that's a real philosophical difficulty with affirmative therapy. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to work as a psychotherapist with these split off autistic parts of the psyche, which are encapsulated and pushed into the body. It's difficult because autism and autistic traits, difficult to work with. We can't symbolize them. We have to find different ways of working. And it's difficult because the patient will resist it. As I said earlier, they're going to resist getting back in touch with their body and symbolizing what's been trapped there because they're frightened of it. And it's also difficult as a therapist because you can end up hating the patient because you're trying to help them and they're hating you for trying to help them. And you're trying to be this good, nice person and they're experiencing you as a repetition of the abuser. But there's your opportunity. Actually, this is where Winnicott is so brilliant, because he says that what gets repeated in transference, the therapeutic relationship, that's an opportunity. If the patient experiences you as an abuser and they've been abused, that's a repetition in a safe form of an emotional experience which they didn't integrate earlier. And so if you can talk about it and work with it, you can actually manage to help that person regulate their emotions and undo the dissociation and therefore end up not having to have surgery and hormones. It's not easy because none of us like being hated. It's not easy because Winnicott says in order to help a person work with these split off parts of the psyche, we have to be able to work with split off parts of our own psyche. In other words, mad bits, which when they come through, overwhelm us and feel ego alien. You know, my patient, when he got taken over by his anger, he felt, I'm mad. This isn't me. I have to be sane by becoming a girl. And that was his attempt to make himself stay sane. It didn't work for the reasons I've tried to explain. But if I had had him as a patient before he had his surgery, and if I had been able to work with these parts of himself, I'm pretty sure that there would have been periods in my therapy with him where he would have hated me and re-experienced me as being abusive for trying to put him in touch with parts of his psyche that he would rather not know about because he experienced them as toxic and overwhelming. So the art is how to safely allow the patient to re-experience that feeling, that experience within the safety of a containing analytic relationship. So I'm trying to, or a psychotherapeutic or a psychodynamic relationship. So I'm saying these patients are a real challenge to us to work with psychologically. They raise fundamental issues about the nature of the mind-body relationship, about what identity is. You know, are we our bodies? Are we our minds? Or are we some relationship between our minds and our bodies? What's health? Is psychological health splitting off from an overwhelming emotion in the body that you can't handle because it's driving you mad? Or is health facing that emotion and bringing the mind back into contact with the body, as Winnicott said? That's my little rant about Winnicott, the mind-body relationship and its links with dissociation. I can give references after the talk on some of the Winnicott papers. Yeah, I'll send a list. Okay, so, you know, that's really all I wanted to say.
My mind is racing hearing all of this, because in some ways you are talking about the universal ways in which we work with clients, particularly traumatized clients, and bring the parts into the room. But it does seem to have another meta level of complexity, existential complexity, because as you say, this projection, the sense of self, is based on something that isn't physical. It's an idea of self outside of the body, which makes me think about why it is so incredibly painful for trans-identified clients who feel they're not being validated by other people. So I am really wondering about how in the client room you manage to keep the part of the person that is healthy enough engaged with the therapeutic alliance?
First of all, I need to point out that I'm talking about some of the most extreme cases, really, where there's a powerful dissociation between the mind and the body, and there's a fear of fragmentation, which is psychotic in its level. You know, there's an anxiety that is so huge that there can be a fragmentation and a loss of unit self. You know, Winnicott would talk about a fear of breakdown. Winnicott's true self is the self that's embodied, the self which is a mind-body unity, or what does he call it? He sometimes calls it personalization, where the instead of depersonalization, where the body feels completely unreal or the world feels real, unreal, and you're just stuck in your mind. He talks about personalization, where you have an embodied sense of being linked in with yourself. And that's the Winnicottian true self. The false self is the self that's dissociated from the body and from the difficult emotions trapped there, and is identified with a disembodied mind. So I think if you read Winnicott on working with the false self, well, that's how to work with it. This is to do with what happens when a patient is giving you an image of themselves that they want you to affirm and to work with, but actually there's something else going on beneath the surface that they've had to disown or dissociate from in order to keep up that false self. And then what he says is that you have to build a therapeutic relationship over a long period of time where the person can trust you enough be as open and honest as they can. You work with the body feelings, because the body symptom is giving you an indication of what's been dissociated from. It's as if the body is hanging on to something that is a clue to what's been dissociated from. So somebody who's being sexually abused, their body remembers something maybe, you know, not everybody, but they might remember something, but they don't know what it is. They go and see the doctor. They've got this gynecological pain. They're investigated. Nothing is found. And the person says, well, it feels like somebody's pushing something inside me. And they describe it, and they don't want to describe it, and you don't want to hear it, but it turns out that it's a body memory of sexual abuse by their father. But for that to be recovered as a recovered memory, the person needs a safe relationship where they feel contained and okay about talking about themselves in this really disturbed way that challenges even their picture of who they are, because they've dissociated from that experience. And I think that's where we need to modify our technique sometimes as well, because if we're too strict, too boundaried, and we just chuck a person who's recovering horrific memories of sexual abuse out into the world, they often can't cope. More commonly, they just close off and they just don't want to go there, and they just end the therapy. So I think we've got to, I think our work is challenged by severe trauma and severe mind-body dissociation. And I think we need to rethink a bit about how we manage boundaries responsibly, but flexibly, you know, not so inflexibly that the person is stuck with an experience which is overwhelming and they feel alone with and they can't manage. Those are the sorts of issues that come up. But generally speaking, I think it's a question of creating a safe enough environment for the person and then actually trusting that there is a part of the psychosoma that wants to bring about a reintegration. That if you listen to that person, and if they listen to themselves and to their bodies, if you listen to their dreams, if you make use of what's going on in the room between the two of you, eventually there's a possibility for something to emerge which is more integrated, where the dissociation is undone. And what Winnicott says is that sometimes what will happen is that you'll have this period of time when everything seems to be really nice, and then you do something apparently stupid and irrational and you fail your patient, and then there's a threat to the relationship. The patient can feel so badly traumatized and let down that that's experienced as a catastrophe. And the danger, that's when the therapy can become very dangerous, because the relationship can break. But if you can stay with it and help the person regulate the emotions around current rupture in the therapeutic relationship, help them to see how the intensity of the emotion is made far greater because it's carrying the significance of the earlier rupture, which has not been properly experienced or integrated yet, manage to separate the two, survive the present rupture and begin to repair it, and also use this as an opportunity to explore what went on in the early relationship that hasn't yet been experienced, then that's when the whole enterprise begins to link up past with present, mind with body, male with female parts of the psyche, abusive parts of the patient's psyche with abused parts, and the same in the therapist, mad parts with sane parts. That's when the whole thing becomes possible. But there has to be a kind of a trust that there is an underlying move towards health or integration, or what Jung called the individuation, which I think comes from a deeper place than the ego. It comes from something deeper within the self, within the psyche, which Jung would call the self. And I think Winnicott would also call the self, but not with a capital S. So there's something that we can do where we can trust in the self-healing potential of the psyche, that there is something that wants to bring about a reintegration and undo a dissociation. And if we can follow that, then we can accompany the patient on this quite painful journey to reintegration, and potentially for these trans patients, make surgery and hormones unnecessary. I mean, if you haven't read it, have a look at my paper, Transgender Medicalization, which is free open access online. I kind of tie a lot of these arguments up together.
I'm wondering, how much do you feel the sort of switch from being a patient to being a customer is impacting expectations of a client in the counselling room?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, we've managed to create cross-sex hormones in a laboratory. We've managed to create puberty blockers in a laboratory. You know, plastic surgery becomes able to fashion a neo-vagina. DSM creates a category, gender dysphoria, which is the diagnosis that you have to have in order to qualify for getting these treatments. But it is driven, a lot of it, by consumerism, by commodification of surgical and hormonal procedures with little or no concern about what the long-term medical consequences or the long-term psychological consequences of these treatments are.
It does also make a client being able to tolerate that therapeutic alliance, which is sometimes challenging, that bit harder, doesn't it? Particularly in this area where we're being told we have to affirm and we've gone away from the watchful waiting model.
Absolutely right, aren't you? And also, in this particular case, even though the person may be traumatized and the best way to work may be in the same way as working with other trauma, the patient can throw accusations of transphobia or attempts to practice conversion therapy at you. And suddenly you've got a kind of a complaint against you. And if this goes into law, you could even have a legal case against you just for trying to help a person work in an ordinary way with their trauma so that they can become re-embodied. You know, they can make friends with their body again by facing the difficult experience which is trapped there and regulating the dysregulated emotions around it. And if in so doing, their gender identity doesn't defensively retreat into a dissociated femininity or masculinity, but actually reintegrates with the contrasexual part of the psyche, well, you could be accused of practicing gender identity conversion therapy. So, you know, because the person's gender identity would change, wouldn't it, as a result of the treatment. And just by simply saying, I'd rather this person work with this difficult experience psychotherapeutically before they do something permanent to their bodies, you could be accused of practicing conversion therapy. So this does give the client a huge amount of power, I think. And I think a lot of therapists who find themselves just practicing affirmation therapy are just frightened, and they're just going along with what the client wants as a consumer, and they're not prepared to do what they should be doing as a therapist, which is to question the client's narrative and to help them make an informed decision about what's best for them, having worked through psychological issues like trauma, dissociation, homophobia, autism. You know, these are the common things which a lot of the trans clients suffer from, but if we simply affirm the identity and push them along the path towards gender and hormones, we're not really doing them any favors, even though in terms of their omnipotent disembodied mental conception of what they want, we're pleasing them, we're going along with them. You might say, under very strict criteria, there aren't many people who regret it, but I bet if you ask the majority of people who've had this surgery and hormones, honestly, do you think this was worth it, knowing then what you know now about having to dilate your neo-vagina and disinfect it because it's smelling a lot and getting prone to infection. And anyway, you can't really properly orgasm from it. And when you do, it's through a phantom penis and you still ejaculate from your prostate because you've still got it. And your increased risk of dementia and of heart attack, and you're 50% more likely to be dead after 18 and a half years. Would you still go through with it? I think a lot of people, or would you rather try some psychotherapy that may be painful but could help you to reintegrate dissociated parts of your experience? I think if people were honest, a lot of them would say, actually, you know what? I think I might have chosen another path. I don't regret it, so I'm not going to be part of the medical figures of regret. But I think maybe I was a bit avoidant. Maybe I was attempting to avoid my psychological issues. You know, and there were people around who said how pleased they were to have transitioned. And there were, I think there was the Harry Benjamin Society, which was a support group for early transsexuals, as they called themselves then. And his experience was that once he realized he'd made a mistake, he wanted to talk about it. And he started writing some blogs later on. And these people who had been so supportive to him when he wanted to transition started attacking him, vilifying him, making his life so miserable that the only way that he could stop them harassing him and bullying him was to falsely claim that he'd made up the whole story. And I know it was a false claim because I work with the guy, you know, so. And people talk about transphobia, but what about the reaction of people who have transitioned to people who have detransitioned? there's so much more rejection and vilification. So, you know, I think there's we could call it detransphobia, couldn't we? That the trans community has a reaction where they can't bear to allow anybody to talk about their experience of detransition without completely negating them. And also, I think the idea that can't bear to think that you might have made a mistake in yourself, because that would make the meaning of your life, you know, compromise your identity and your social life. And, you know, so I think these guys end up sometimes policing in other people the doubts that they can't countenance in themselves. You know, if you can't bear to think maybe I made a mistake, remaining part of the community and remaining sure of yourself requires that you don't doubt the correctness of your own transition. Then I think you can end up feeling very threatened if you see it in the outside world. A bit like the worst, the people who are most likely to beat up gay people are people who are denying their own latent homosexuality and feel terribly threatened by seeing gay people. So, you know, in the same way, I think if you have a doubt about if you see people coming back and saying, yeah, I've made a mistake, then I think that creates, for some people, an intolerable doubt, which they then have to stamp out.
Thank you, Bob, for sharing your insights. It's been really, really helpful. And I hope this recording is helpful and offers some insight for others who may be listening later.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to know more about Thoughtful Therapists, do check out our website at thoughtfultherapists.org.